Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Kelly Jean Kelly, Dorothy Gundy, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Kelly Jean Kelly.
More than half of American workers say they are stressed because their employers do not give them the information they need to do their jobs. This information comes from a company called Dynamic Signal. It sells communications systems that enable businesses to send messages to workers' mobile devices. The Dynamic Signal study involved 1,001 people who work in the United States. They answered a series of questions online at the beginning of 2019. The study found that 80% of the workers reported feeling stressed or under pressure because of poor communication by their employers. The same study showed that more than 60% of those asked said they are ready to leave their companies. And it said the most unsatisfied workers are those who cannot look at work email regularly. They include workers in stores, hotels, restaurants, hospitals, and buildings where products are stored, as well as delivery drivers. These workers are more likely to say that their companies communicate better with employees who work in offices. Russ Fraden is the head of Dynamic Signal. He says that over time, many businesses have stayed the same. But what workers expect has changed. In the past, companies communicated with employees by putting up signs in the break room or on the factory floor. Or they might have used newsletters or magazines. But today, 77% of Americans own smartphones, and workers are used to getting information pushed to them immediately. Their phones can show information about bank account balances, sporting events, and possible love interests from a dating service, notes Fraden. So, he says, when workers receive information they need to know for their jobs an hour late, or 3 days late, or 2 weeks late, they are likely to be angry. It's really just about bringing the types of tools around your mobile phone that everyone is used to in their day-to-day life into the workplace, he adds. Other studies also show a growing dissatisfaction with how workplaces communicate to employees. A company called StaffBase produces software programs for workplace communication. It says that 74% of U.S. employees feel they are missing out on company news and information. In addition, a 2017 Gallup survey found that just 13% of employers thought that company communications were effective. The Harvard Business Review also published an article about how companies can use mobile phone applications to improve employee communication. For example, the story said, businesses could send company announcements or information about payments and other assistance directly to workers on their phones. Improving workplace communications can be good for a company's profit. Gallup's 2017 State of the American Workplace report found that companies with more engaged workers keep employees longer and bring in more money. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Malala Yousafzai is known for promoting education as a basic right, especially education for women and children. The 21-year-old Pakistani activist became world famous after she was shot in the head by a Taliban militant. At the time, the Taliban was fighting for control of her hometown in northwest Pakistan. She was attacked for expressing support for the education of girls. Malala Yousafzai has won awards for her human rights work. In 2014, at the age of 17, she was the youngest person to win the Nobel Peace Prize. She shared the 2014 Peace Prize with a child rights campaigner from India. Yousafzai has written books, and many books have been written about her. A bookstore in Vienna, Virginia, had a special event on a Saturday morning last month. It asked two women who have books about Yousafzai to come and read from their works. Young children, their parents, and grandparents came to hear the two authors.
Malala was recovering from a serious injury. It was a miracle she could stand up at all. But she stood up in front of the whole world to prove that words have power.
That was Karen Leggett Aburaya reading from her book, Malala Yousafzai, Warrior with Words. The crowd also heard from Jenny L. Walsh, author of the book She Dared, Malala Yousafzai.
Malala was a very good speaker, much like her father. People listened to him, and it seemed that people wanted to listen to Malala, too. Her first speech was publicized across Pakistan with the title, How Dare the Taliban Take Away My Basic Right to Education?
In the year 2007, the influence of the Taliban was growing in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Malala Yousafzai's father owned a school and supported her writing about life under the Taliban for a British website. Pakistani forces and the Taliban fought for control of the Swat Valley. Schools for girls were closed. Malala continued to write and speak publicly about the importance of education for all children, especially girls. Her life changed forever in 2012. When she was 15 years old. On a ride home from school, a Taliban gunman got on her bus. He shot Malala and two of her friends. They survived, but Malala's wounds were severe. She was taken to a hospital in Birmingham, England, where wounded soldiers were treated. There, she recovered with no lasting injury to her brain. Less than a year later, when she turned 16, Malala was at the United Nations in New York, speaking out for education. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Robots are increasingly being developed to think and act like humans. But one common human quality that has been difficult for engineers to recreate in machines is humor. Most robots are powered by artificial intelligence, or AI, and machine learning technology. Some have performed better than humans in tests designed to measure machine intelligence. For example, we have reported on experiments involving robots competing against humans in a reading test and in a live debate. Computer scientists have also hoped to give robots technical skills to help them recognize, process, and react to humor. But these attempts have mostly failed. AI experts say that in many cases, attempts to make robots understand humor end up producing funny results, but not in the way they were supposed to. Kiki Hempelmann is a computational language expert who studies humor at Texas A&M University Commerce. Artificial intelligence will never get jokes like humans do, he told the Associated Press. The main problem, Hempelmann says, is that robots completely miss the context of humor. In other words, they do not understand the situation or related ideas that make a joke funny. Other experts who study the subject agree that context is very important to understanding humor, both for humans and for robots. Tristan Miller is a computer scientist and linguist at Darmstadt University of Technology in Germany. He also spoke to the AP. In one research project, he studied more than 10,000 puns. Puns are a kind of joke that uses a word with two meanings. For example, you could say, balloons do not like pop music. The word pop can be a way of saying popular music, or pop can be the sound a balloon makes when it explodes. But a robot might not get the joke. Tristan Miller says that is because humor is a kind of creative language that is extremely difficult for computer intelligence to understand. It's because it relies so much on real-world knowledge, Miller said. This includes background knowledge and common sense knowledge. A computer doesn't have these real-world experiences to draw on. It only knows what you tell it and what it draws from, he added. Allison Bishop is a computer scientist at New York's Columbia University. She also performs stand-up comedy. She told the AP a big problem is that machines are trained to look for patterns. Comedy, on the other hand, relies on things that stay close to a pattern but not completely within it. To be funny, humor must also not be predictable, Bishop said. This makes it much harder for a machine to recognize and understand what is funny. Bishop says since robots have great difficulty understanding humor, she feels like it gives her better job security as a comedy performer. It even made her parents happy when her brother decided to become a full-time comedy writer because it meant he would not be replaced by a machine, she added. Purdue University computer scientist Julia Reyes has spent 15 years trying to get computers to understand humor. The results, she says, have at times been laughable. In one experiment, she gave the computer two different groups of sentences. Some were jokes, others were not. The computer kept mistaking things as jokes that were not. When Reyes asked the computer why it thought something was a joke, the answer made complete sense, technically. But, she said, the results coming from the computer were not funny, nor memorable. Despite the difficulties, Darmstadt University's Miller says there are good reasons to keep trying to teach humor to robots. It could make machines more relatable, especially if they can learn to understand sarcasm, he noted. Humans use sarcasm to say one thing but mean another. But Texas A&M's Kiki Hempelman is not sure such attempts are a good idea. Teaching AI systems humor is dangerous because they may find it where it isn't, and they may use it where it's inappropriate, he said. Maybe bad AI will start killing people because it thinks it is funny, he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And, he said, Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain, but Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. He urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoar spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence. The idea that all men are created equal, and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some who had opposed the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.